All right, so for this segment, we're going to kickstart with our Q&A segment. So thank you for writing in on the comment section of our YouTube channel. And very thankful that the first couple of episodes, a lot of comments have came in, and we hope to answer some of the key questions that you guys have. So let's kickstart with the first question. Okay, so we have this question on the sizes of our houses have shrunken over the years. And why don't... as we have Beatrice to read out our question for us, we also want to introduce our new guest, Beatrice. Let's welcome Beatrice.
Yay. I'm Beatrice. I'm with PLB. Been with PLB for the last 3 years, three plus years. I'm a listing consultant manager. I specialize in the CCR, so D9, 10, 11.
Right, awesome. Mm-hmm. And of course, share with us a little bit about your entrepreneurship journey last time.
Oh, I used to bake a lot of cupcakes.
Awesome. Yeah. Great. Yeah. I tasted the cupcakes before. I think PLB had like 2 boxes.
More than that.
8 boxes free.
Awesome.
Yeah. You used to bake for us this year. We gave out the clients before.
Yes, we did.
Awesome.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Okay. Can you restart the cupcake baking for fun?
Sure. If you set up a kitchen in the office.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. We're going to do it. Okay, and of course, we have Yurong and Grace back with us. And Ashar, I shouldn't comment on the dressing because already somebody has commented on our YouTube channel about our cardigans. And that's why I stopped wearing cardigans today. No lah, no kidding. I love cardigans. I have like 5. I just bought another 3. But Yurong somehow just copied. And you look great, the cardigan. Thank you. It's okay. keep the comments coming in because we love to interact with our audience. And of course, for this episode, we're going to have a new cam position. And of course, that is to banter as well with our producers. Let's have a look. Give that a round of applause. Woo!
Oh, no.
All right.
This is awkward.
Right. Enough of the introduction. Let's have Beatrice read us the first question.
Okay, so this question is from John Lim. He gives a shout out to Wayne. Had transacted with Wayne recently and good experience all around with PLB. So his question is, the sizes of our houses have not shrunk over the years while the prices keep going up for both HDB and private. It's understandable that all property owners would like to see the prices go up over the years. However, do you all see Singapore going towards the direction of Hong Kong in 15 to 20 years where plenty of young people are not able to afford houses? Is HDB going to be selling easily in excess of $1 million? Is that going to be a norm? And is there also going to be a limit on how much grant the government can give?
Awesome. Thanks, John, for this question. Great question. What do you think, Grace, about this?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a fantastic question from John. I think it's a really empathetic question also, because John is like looking from the perspective of, you know, moving forward in the real estate market. Are the young people of Singapore still going to be able to afford housing? And that's a question that I think myself and a lot of my friends are thinking about as well. So I think, okay, initially John says the sizes of our houses haven't shrunk.
Mm.
Okay, so I think, I'm not sure whether it's a typo, but if we were to pull up a chart that we were discussing previously, actually we will notice after the 2013 TDSR measures, the sizes of our homes have actually shrunk.
Honey, I shrunk the kids. Yes. Did you watch that show? Honey, I shrunk the kids. It's the best show. You should watch it. Okay.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, so let's say we can put up the charts, right? The sizes of our homes have actually shrunken quite a fair bit, especially after the 2013 TDSR measures, in a bid to keep the quantum more affordable.
Right.
So as PSF goes up, but you still want to keep the quantum affordable and the quantum low, so developers have actually started making smaller and smaller units. So I believe that was John's question, actually. That was his intention, that the houses have shrunk, but the prices have maintained.
Mm.
Right. So moving forward, you know, and he also says that it's understandable that all property owners will want the prices to go up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so funny story is that, you know, sometimes I post some kind of TikTok videos and then people will be commenting like, you know, like the prices keep going up. Like, how can you be selling homes at this kind of price? And then there are some... other people who reply to these comments, right? And they'll say things like, of course, the prices have to go up, right? If the prices are going down, it might signal like unhealthy economy,
right?
And homes in Singapore is traditionally for like asset progression and to help people to accumulate more wealth in terms of like storing in their asset or for retirement purposes. So I think prices have to logically go up, and the next guy is going to want to sell higher than the previous person. That's just the logical thing, right? So, okay, back to the question. Whether we see Singapore going towards the direction of Hong Kong.
Maybe I'll pose this question to Yu Rong.
Okay. Yeah.
What do you think? You have been quite quiet today.
Because it's not my time to speak.
Yes.
Okay, I think like generally, I think our landscape is pretty different from Hong Kong. A few things. Number one, I think the government has done a great job with regards to supply with new flats in regards to the HDB segment. Right, so let's start with HDB segment first. And because the government can decide when to launch, how much supply to launch on every single year by looking at application rate for BTO or like resale prices, there's an indication to how much price has moved, right? So when prices gone up too much, they can always come in to navigate the supply by giving more supply. And what happens is HDB actually controls how much they were going to price their BTO flats. And if we were to use like recent like Tengah launches, right, which is a 4-room flat starting from about 350 plus over $1,000, using a median income of $4,000 per person, which means the household income is about 8,000, right? So there is about 4 times in terms of annual income. Right. So there is how the government decide that how they were going to price the BTOs to make it affordable, that is in line with the income. So I think the government does a great job on that. Even though we have already have very limited land in Singapore, but we are creating new land space, new land, new townships, I would say, like, for example, Tengah, and there will be other areas that we can still clear some forests to actually have like future townships. So with all the good planning, I think we will not be in the same direction as Hong Kong.
I think in terms of this Hong Kong and Singapore pricing kind of comparison, I think this will be in the same direction if we're just talking about private property. But once we put HDB into the picture, it will be very different. The reason is because one of the reasons why we have such a high ownership rate, just refer to this chart, right? But of course, this was back in 2020. Now, our home ownership rate is actually hovering at about 89% based on the last check. That was because of our public housing scheme. And over the years, actually, a lot of countries has came to Singapore to visit to actually have the tour on how our government actually instituted the HDB policies to ensure that Singaporeans have a very high chance to get their own shelter, own home, and the creation of CPF and all that. So I think this is the part that differs. Because example, if you look at Japan, actually Japan, if you back in the past when there was a lot of so-called like, I wouldn't say hype, there was a lot of interest in investing in Japan properties. In fact, now investors over the world, they will still invest in various parts of different countries in a sense. But one statistics on Japan is that a lot of the tenants are actually the Japanese themselves. Yeah. So example, if you buy a property in Tokyo or in Osaka, actually the key tenant pool are Japanese themselves. They're coming from different parts of the Japan landscape to work in the core city. So Singapore is very different. We're so small. And this actually forms the bedrock of a lot of our price stability, is because Singaporeans, they have a home themselves, and the BTO pricing, it rise over time. If you enter at a BTO price, even if you were to buy a resale property at the first property, what is the current grant, Yu Rong?
The current grant is up to 180K for a 4-room flat.
Great. There was another question.
190K.
Okay, of course, that is tiered based on income. But minimally, first-time couple, resale property, 4-room.
80,000 for a first-timer grant, 30K for up to 30K for near parents. The rest will be enhanced housing grant.
Right. So there was a very good question. One of our audience asked us like, okay, so sorry, is this question. This is also going to be a limit on how much grant the government can give. I think one thing that our government has very cleverly crafted is that the grant is in the form of CPF. It is actually an injection of CPF funds into your CPF. And when you sell the place next time, they're not going to take back the money from you. They need you to return that money into your own CPF. So you can utilize it for the next property. So I think this part is well controlled. And how about Beatrice? What do you think? Is HDB going to be in excess of $1 million? Because seriously, if we were to look at the inventory in the market, there are still properties in the range of about $500,000, yeah. $600,000. What do you think?
Actually, recently, I think Property Guru did a survey. Mm. I think it was in one of the articles that we read this week where they did a survey and they polled Singaporeans. Basically, this poll was to find out like what is the sentiment on the ground right now. And they found that actually 3 in 10 people found it reasonable for resale HDB flats to be sold in excess of 1 million. Mm. So 3 out of 10. So despite the growing affordability concerns, 3 out of 10, and they found that this sentiment is higher for those aged 30 to 39. Right. So like the higher, older demographic as well as your higher income earners.
Right.
And actually these transactions make up a very, very small percentage. Mm. I think in January, I think this quarter for transactions this year, $1 million HDB transaction, I think maybe less than 2%, right. 1 point something.
Yeah, percent. Generally speaking, you can still get a HDB property at about 500,000 averagely, or 600,000.
I mean, of course, we are seeing larger units, rarer unit types like EAs, jumbos, mostly mature estates, and people are willing to pay lah for these. either it's a location thing, like it's in a prime location, or it's a size thing.
Right. Mm. So thanks, Beatrice. I mean, looking at this chart, this is where our population is in 2021. That was about 2 years back. Right now, of course, our population stands at about 5.8, 5.9 million. The target is 7 million by 2030. By the time we are 7 million, I think for sure, if we are just talking about private property and landed properties, because we need to bring back that chart again that talks about the demographics in terms of percentages of ownership. And which one? We have too many charts. Okay, this one. Okay. Yeah, so back to John's question. If we are talking about private property prices, I'm very confident that because we only have this, and if you look at the overall stock of residential properties, HDB forms about 75% of the total stock, and then private properties with landed properties at about 4 to 5%, and this part forms about 20%, meaning that this is the main thing that international demand can go after, especially now Singapore is already a safe haven status. Pricing-wise, I think definitely this will escalate over the next 7 years. So this is, of course, the part that we've always been talking about. And I think but for the majority of the Singapore property in terms of HDB pricing, it should still be the core thing that government is focusing on to ensure that it's affordable. Right. So let's move on to the next question. So we have a question from Dave Bak Choy. Mr. Dave, talking about this super expensive housing a reason to be proud of? Is it an indicator of happiness? What do you think, Grace?
Indicator of happiness?
Yeah,
it's like super happiness expensive index. Housing a reason to be proud of? I think it's... I don't know. How do you measure it, right? Okay, so if we look at... I would say affordable housing for the masses is something to be proud of. Super expensive or luxury... The rise of luxury housing as well as and rising prices in the private sector is something to indicate the health of the economy. Not indicate the health, like, because it could also indicate an unhealthy, you know, a gap in the economy. But I would say that if there's no increase in pricing, if there's no progress, if your housing prices are stagnant always, that's not a good sign also. Yeah. Is it an indicator of happiness? On a personal level or on a community level, right?
I think with Singapore's home ownership rate at 90%, I think most Singaporeans are happy because you can afford, you have choices. You can have a BTO, you can get married. If you don't want to wait, you can get a resale property immediately. And actually, if we calculate backwards, a lot of Singaporeans, if you get married, because with the grant, you technically don't even need the down payment from your CPF because the 80,000 is already credited into your CPF for the first set of down payment for resale property. Of course, I think if we are talking about private properties, the pricing is different. And government cannot restrict the private properties like a HDB property because we are in the free market.
Right.
And there needs to be a liberty portion for private properties, for landed properties and stuff like that.
I think there's no denying, though, that for private properties, it's only going to get more and more expensive. I think it's going to come to a situation where we may see that not everyone will be able to enjoy this kind of asset progression, and less people, in fact, will be able to. It is only those who are currently maybe in the housing market,
right,
that are already in the game, that may stay in the game, but it might become harder and harder for everyone else to own a private asset moving forward.
What does happiness mean for you?
Okay, I think happiness mean for me is everybody. Okay, for me, I would say that knowing my own priorities in life, and as long as those priorities are being met, then I think that I will be contented and happy. In the context of this question, I think, in short summary wise, I feel that because our home ownership is high. So what happens is it means that families have a place that they can call home and feel safe. I think that is important. Whether the price benchmark, I would say that compared to the previous question, right, the government, because they can control the BTO supply and all that, they can keep housing affordable still for like first-time homeowners. In between, whether, you know, like a person can upgrade to a private property and all that, I think that depends on everybody's individual motivation and their own financial health. There is no right or wrong whether they need to move on to a private property, as long as, I think most importantly, there is a safe roof for everybody in your family.
Right. Yeah. Great.
Okay, but I also want to add in one point, right, that yes, housing is affordable for the majority, but what this majority looks like is also a very standard demographic. So you have to be like married, you know, if not, you have to be above 35. So definitely, I think we have to understand that
For the singles, I think it's a bit tough.
Yes,
because correct. You have to wait until 35, and maybe at the age of 30, you already want to have your own space.
Correct.
But you don't have the option to buy a property. Yeah. And let's say if you cannot afford a down payment for a private, or your TDSR doesn't match up, then you have to continue to live with your parents. If not, you have to rent. Mm. Right. So I think for singles, undeniably, I feel that the public policy has a gap on singles' part. Yeah. My personal wish is that it can be brought forward to 28 years old.
Actually, we have an old article. There's an article that we have written before on Insights a long time ago.
Okay. The call for a push.
Yes. No. It's like a debate. Summing up the debate between what would happen if you actually lowered the age for singles eligibility for HDB. This was put forth by, I think, the opposition in one of the parliamentary debates previously. Mm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but I think we don't dive into it now.
Yeah, we can flash the article right here. Okay. I think just as you were talking about happiness, right? I think you have been in real estate for 10 years, I've been like 16 years. But I think we can easily count, like probably I have defrayed families from moving from the HDB to private property. I think easily close to about 50 people, if I can just like have a rough figure. The reason is because sometimes when we see signals in terms of like, their monthly commitment as well as like their TDSR, and we know that it's a stretch for them, we'll actually share with them that actually it might be better for you to move from your current 4-room or 5-room to like an executive apartment or EM if you need more space, because if you have to stretch and you are squeezing into a 3-bedroom condo or 2+ study that's tiny, but you don't have that kind of certainty and comfort level and you're stretching yourself, right, then it might not be a good sign in terms of happiness level, because end of the day, if your disposable income is going to reduce drastically and every month you're thinking about the monthly installment, and it's not a very comfortable kind of move, then it's going to create stress and anxiety with your family. So we always, even if our webinars, we'll share with our clients to really observe financial prudency. Now, Beatrice, moving on to the final question. Why don't you read us the question?
So the question from Tai Hing Sim says, 99-year lease, how to keep going up? Come to a point, lease getting lesser and lesser, price will start to come down.
Great. So, Beatrice, what do you think of 99-year's property in relation to the question?
I think, yes, it's a common concern. The decaying lease, usually people start to become become a little bit more concerned when the lease starts to drop. I think when it starts to come to like the 50-year mark, there are some concerns. But I think we've seen it really depends on the project. I think there are a lot more factors that come into play besides the leasehold.
Right.
There are leasehold projects that outperform freehold projects in certain areas. I think it is really a combination of other factors like location, project size, density, demand for the area. And yeah, sometimes the price appreciation far outweighs the decaying lease.
Right.
Yeah, the negative effects of a decaying lease.
Great.
Yeah.
So I'll give a quick brief before I pass the question to Yurong. So basically, the Balas curve talks about a few key moments. Number one is that all 99's properties will definitely go to zero. So the question is correct. And whether it's a private condominium, whether it's a 99's landed, 99's cluster house, 99's Sentosa luxury property, or HDB 99's property, it will all go to zero. And when it goes to zero, it will be returned to the state because all land are under SLA. So only if you buy freehold or 999's, then is yours in perpetuity. Basically, two key moments to take note. Once it hits a balance lease of 60 years, what is going to happen is that you will start to see a drop in terms of valuation. But sometimes, in uptrend market, things like this defy the odds. For example, if we were to look at Mandarin Gardens, currently 59 years, but price increased over the past 3 years because there was a bull run from 2020 until now. So for example, back in 2020, you can get a 3-bedder at 1528 square feet at about probably $1.7 million. But now, to get a 1528 3-bedder, you need to spend at least $2 million. And it went up by $300,000 over the past 3 years, even though it's 59 years balance lease. Now, once it hits 60 years, the next buyer that's going to buy over your property will have a restriction in the CPF withdrawal. That's the first thing. Number two, if it's below 30 years, your next buyer is not able to get a bank loan. And that's why we call this Balas curve two key moments, in the sense that you have to think of the 60 years balance and the 30 years balance lease. Now, Yurong, what do you think about your thoughts on this question?
I think definitely all 99-year properties will go to zero when it reaches the end of the shelf life. I think we will look at it in two contexts. Right? Number one, is this for own stay? And number two, is it for investment? From an own stay perspective, I think what's importantly what I'll consider is I can still buy into older properties as long as, number one, it should cover my shelf life on earth, right? So if I'm going to...
Okay, what is the average shelf life?
So the average expiry date usually is... Yeah,
in Singapore?
In Singapore, it's about 85 years.
For ladies.
Okay.
For guys, it's 78.
83. Yeah.
Is that the latest one? Because of supplements. Usually guys will have a shorter.
So the joke is, like, usually the females will nag at the guy, so the guy will die first. After that, after the guy dies already, the lady becomes like, you know, like, yeah, this one, cut it out lah.
No. Okay, anyway, to add on to this, right, there was a latest article in US that they just recently found out, averagely, after a person announced their retirement, within 10 years, they have a high chance of passing away. That's the latest research.
What? That means I aim to retire by 30.
No, as in like, the latest research was like, if you announce your retirement and then you don't do anything. That means you don't do maybe community. There's no work or no value that you are engaging. Within 10 years, they find that the rate of passing away is very high. So I think human beings are created to give value and to solve problems and always to add value. That's why I think it's important to keep ourselves engaged and stop talking about retirement, Grace. Okay, sorry, back to you.
Okay, let me get back on track, right? So generally, I think, for example, if I'm 35 years old and I know that likelihood, you know, average age of expiry is 85 years old, so I want to make sure that at least I buy into a property that at least have like 55 years kind of balance lease.
Mm.
Generally, I think that is the responsible thing to consider.
Yes.
So that is why it's important. From an investment standpoint, I will know that, number one, leasehold properties can still go up despite the Bala curve, which is, you know, like supposed to be most expensive on day one.
Right.
And fundamental reason is because for every property, the building price will definitely start depreciating for day one. It's like renovation. But the land price that it sits on is the one that determines whether you have appreciation in your entire 99-year cycle. All All right. So from an investment standpoint, if I want to optimize this, then it will be important for me to decide what is my key timings to enter and exit such that I can still, it can still be profitable for me from an investment standpoint. And of course, two things that I mentioned just now about 99 years leasehold property is the last 30 years banks do not lend you. Right. So what it means is that for the buyer pool will start shrinking. Reason is because even for a like young person trying to buy a 30, okay, let's say a young person, by right, he can take a 30-year loan. He wants to buy a 40-year balance lease. He can only loan from the bank 10 years. And CPF restriction will be if the balance lease plus the youngest buyer don't reach age 95, there will be restriction how much CPF you can use.
Yes.
Okay. And I think lastly, from an investment standpoint, I can still buy into a 30-year balance lease property knowing that it will go down to zero. And it can still be a profitable investment because maybe through the rental potential I can get, a cash-on-cash return can still outperform in other asset classes that I will that I can alternatively put my money in.
Right, you're right. Have a look at this property. So, oh my goodness, look at me.
Oh my God.
When Melvin is still young.
Oh my goodness. This was in 2018. What happened to my hair? Okay. Anyway, this property is less than 30 years old. We sold it. Basically to a buyer that is paying full cash. And so I think in Singapore, because we are so small, this even properties that are below 30 years old attracts a certain category of buyers. So basically for this particular family that bought into this place, they want a landed home, though it's below 30 years old, but they are fully paying it. And they have the cash ability. So compared to buying this particular area, this is in Hillview, you have to pay probably about $7 million. This is, of course, at a much lower quantum. And the family already decided that they will hold it until the end. So they want a place to stay. And this is, of course, a very interesting house because it's like sort of like a dual key. There's an outhouse. You're like buying two landed at on one piece of land. So it's a very interesting property. You can still, it's still on property. It's still on our PLB YouTube channel. You can still head back to see at Fuyong Estate. Of course, the entire Fuyong Estate is there's a portion of it that are on a 99 years lease, and of course now I think the balance lease is probably about 20 years or something. I need to double check on that. There was a particular stretch in Geylang that has already been returned to SLA, and you can refer to a couple of articles online as well. Okay, so I think we need to move.
I got one quick thing to add.
Yes.
So for example, right, it can still make sense, right, to buy like a old balance lease property, right? Rationale is because, for example, citing that example, if let's say I have 50 years to go to heaven, yes, and I know that compared to renting a vis kind of property, right, ownership still makes sense because I only pay maximum a 30-year kind of installment, and then I get to occupy 20 years for free. Versus if I were to choose not to purchase, and I will have to eventually keep renting perpetually until I go to heaven. Hopefully, I go to heaven.
Okay. You wrong. Okay. So that is linked to this because I think if we were to look at this chart that I think Grace was trying to answer previously about the 2013 chasm gap of TDSR that developers started to create, smaller and smaller properties, and majority are smaller properties. And of course, we track the new launches based on lease type, as well as in terms of segments, OCR, CCR, of course, this is all regions, all right? So let's hold this chart in mind. And then we look at what happened over the launches that happened in Feb and March. So there were two key launches that were launched. Botany at Dairy Farm, Terra Hill. Freehold, 99 years.
Yeah.
Botany was so close to 48%. Terra Hill, 38%, all right? And if you look at this, unit sold at an average of 2070 PSF, Singapore's become 85% of the buyers. Okay. Now, I think there's also a shift in mindset over the years. The shift happens because, just have a look at the percentage of 99 years properties being created, because GLS are all 99 years now. Freehold now is like about 15% of all the launches. In the past, it was different. In the past, you look at the properties, there's close to about 40% freehold properties, the red color ones. And then now, majority 99. I think there has been a shift in mindset over the last 10 years that actually people buying new launches now, their mindset could be that anyway, I will sell after TOP, after occupying 5 years after TOP, after occupying 10 years after I take my keys. it doesn't really matter to me if it's a free or NITEC or NINA. And that could be the reason why botany, compared to Terre Haute, has a higher percentage. So because they will be looking at the PSF difference, even though they know that they are getting a freehold, but because maybe they have a midterm mindset, it doesn't really mean they have to hold until all the way. What do you think, Beatrice, of this? Would you go for a freehold or 99 if it's a new launch, personally?
Personally? Freehold or 99, I think, like you say, I think from the stats, I think if the price differential, if the disparity between the freehold and the new launch is significant, like the botany is an average 2,000 PSF.
Right.
And then for... what is the numbers for
Terre Haute is about 2.6.
Yeah, 2.6 is the average selling.
If it's like a $600 PSF disparity, if I'm considering, you know, lifestyle factors, and then I'm also considering maybe overall quantum.
Right.
And both products are very similar, then I think if my appetite, maybe if I'm only, let's say if I only, my appetite is maybe, I don't know, 1 million for the smallest one bedroom type.
Right.
Then maybe I'll go for the 99 rather than the freehold.
Right.
Because to me, the price disparity is more important.
Great. So you go for quantum play.
Yeah, quantum.
And of course, affordability.
Mm.
Great. Yeah. Yurong, how much is the one plus study at botany? Why are you laughing?
One plus study for botany.
Is it because of Nuggets is here?
I think for botany, price.
Okay, sorry, one plus study starting from 988,000.
So it's about $1 million. Yeah. Of course, that's the one that Grace won, right? Because she guessed that two plus study would be a sold out.
Was it botany?
Yeah, you guessed botany.
Okay, generally, this morning, I think when I checked, one plus study, two bit compact, two bit, two buff.
No more already.
No more.
Yeah.
Everything is gone.
The one and two bidders mainly.
Okay.
Two plus study, I think only left three units.
Great.
Okay, but of course the product is very different in these cases, right? Like the location, the target audience. I think everything is... Even the... I would say the design.
I mean, one is Hillview, one is Pasir Panjang, one is D21, one is D5.
The target audience and the... Yeah, like family type. Okay, I mean, both are like family types. Right. Both have own stay with a component of... I think just the separate locations, the products are completely different. Yeah. So it's hard to compare. I mean, if we really want to compare, then it would be freehold versus leasehold in the same area. Maybe that would be a fairer comparison.
Great, great. All right, so we're done with our Q&A segment. And we need to have a look at this latest news over the past 2 weeks. So basically, this was fresh out of the oven for the past 10 days. Our ministers confident that the ramp-up supply, and this is talking about BTO supply, because it's going to be close to about 150 BTOs by the year 2025-2026. Cooling measures will stabilize the property market. And the cutout on this part is that they expect more price impact on 3 and 4 resale. Could be less impact on large flats as additional grants are noticeably smaller for 5-room and bigger resale. Plus, the latest news is that volume has dipped in Feb, month to month in Feb, unchanged. So the curve has flattened over 1 month.
After 31 months of straight
increment, right?
Yeah.
So what do we think about this pricing? I mean, what do you guys think?
I think they were saying like these numbers, it might not be a sign that the market is could be a seasonal thing because January, I mean, we had CNY.
Right.
And then, you know, over the festive season, people traveling and all that. So it could be, you know, because if you look at the year-on-year, February in 2022 versus February of this year, the volume transactions is quite on par. So it just could be a seasonal pattern.
Right. How about Yurong? What do you feel about the price trend right now on the ground?
Maybe I talk about the volume first, right? So I think like generally I would say that real estate is very, very different from like stock market, right? So you actually don't have to really focus on like the month-to-month changes, especially in terms of volume. Let's talk about like pre-COVID. That we know that usually quarter one and quarter four will have the lowest volume of transaction. And quarter one and quarter four will have the lowest volume of transaction. Quarter two and quarter three will have the highest volume of transaction, right? Reason is because it links to the holiday season. And the other thing is, so if knowing this context, and then if we always compare a month to month, there's a volume drop, there's a volume increase, but it is part of seasonal changes. So there is not too much to read about it. That's point one. Second thing they can talk about, like new launch volume changes. New launch volume will be very decided by developers when they want to launch, which month they want to launch. If they decide to launch this month, of course the volume will dip. So if we see it from a very minor context, the story is insignificant. Don't have to pay attention to it. Same thing I would say in terms of price index-wise from a month-to-month basis. You can't tell a story yet. You can't tell a story yet on what is the new trend that is performing, because usually, I would say that if you can see a pattern over like 3 to 4 quarters, then it's easier to tell whether are we on the uptrend? Are we actually showing that now we are consolidating? So consolidating meaning that maybe we are fluctuating plus 1%, minus 1% over a certain period of time, right? Because it cannot be always going up. Or is it on like a downtrend basis? So right. I think it's a bit like too early to tell. Mm. But I will generally think that if you can start consolidating, definitely that will be good news for aspiring first-time homeowners that wants to get into the HDB segment.
Right.
Right. And I think most of the time from like how I plan portfolio for my clients is that I really don't pay too much attention to the price index. I share my clients. The price index, whether it's HDB or private property, it is more like an emotional barometer, right? What it means is that it showcases what is the emotional context of the general market of the property type that you're looking at. If it's going up, obviously, you know, like if people are excited about it. If it's going down, then people are concerned about it.
Right.
But what's important is whether the property that I choose, number one, does it have the right criteria? And I entering at the correct pricing? Because I have shown many examples to my clients that while, let's say, you know, like in the private property price index, 2013 quarter two was one of the last peak. I have helped my clients bought in 2014 when the property price index has been going down from 2013 all the way until 2018.
Yeah.
Sorry, 2013 all the way until 2017, the price has been going down, but we managed to buy a property and still be profitable.
Mm.
Right. So it is more importantly your own property selection at the price that you enter rather than just looking at the index.
Great. Great. Awesome. Thanks for sharing that part. A quick shout out to our webinar that is upcoming. And this is upcoming on the 27th of March, 2023. And of course, like what Euro mentioned about the price indexes just now, in our very last webinar, which is making the right move, comprehensive approach to HDB to whether is it suitable for you to come to a private property market in this current season based on your own financial prudency, your life stage, as well as your time horizon to move. So during that webinar, we talked about the fact that timing the market, sometimes playing with time as well, because we only have this time in terms of the fact that it's not even called a commodity. You cannot even buy back time.
Limited runway.
Yeah, and our runway is limited, but our point of loan capability in terms of leveraging, in terms of, I mean, like the very fundamental reason why buying properties, there's always a leverage component, is because firstly, property is a physical asset with collateral as a collateral. Secondly, is that if you base it on time preference, if let's say my mindset is that I only want to buy a property when I save up $1 million, by the time I will be, I don't know how old already, right? But now I can own a property with a $250,000 down payment and stamp duty, but I can live in it now, I can build my family, I can create memories, I can have a shelter. That's the reason why there's a leverage component in this economy. And we talked about that during the last one. If I missed that, the next one will be 27 March, where we're going to talk about landed property investment strategies. But fret not, if you miss the HDB segment one, there's going to be a repeat telecast with a different content angle coming down the road as well. Right. So a quick shout out to our webinar team. And of course, you can head on to propertybrothers.com webinar where we talk about this in depth. Okay, I want to bring our question to our producers. So, Daniel. Is it okay to share with our audience your age?
I'm 28 this year.
All right. Young.
Yeah.
And do you think that, okay, so I was just browsing through here just to have a look at the prices of Woodlands HDB apartments. Of course, I sought them out by price quantum and I filtered them based on only 4-room apartments. So basically, the lowest quantum right now is basically for 4-room flat, it's at 355,000, followed by 300 plus, couple of choices right here. So Daniel, when you turn age 35, if let's say you are still single, and of course, if you found a partner, suitable partner earlier, I believe you'll get a property soon. Do you think that the property prices of HDB apartments in the resale market are high now? Or actually, sometimes it's because of the hate news focusing on all the $1 million properties, but actually there's a lot of properties available in the market. What do you think?
Honestly, with the
focus being on $1 million HDBs popping up, right? It actually made me feel like, not say desperate, just like scared. Like just generally scared at looking at how $1 million HDB will be the norm in the future. So like...
But based on what you see now, what do you think?
Based on what I see.
On this property guru screen.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of Woodlands, right? I would say generally they are quite affordable. But I also have to take into account the balance lease. I think generally the Woodlands are quite mature or reaching into the mature estate.
So are you worried about buying an older HDB with, let's say, like balance 65 years? Are you worried? After what you heard about us talking about the Ballast curve, are you worried?
Yes, definitely. So I guess the takeaway is I have to get married soon.
Great. What do you think, Steffers?
Any takers can intro?
Yes, please flash Daniel's... Anyway, but Daniel is also multi-talented. We train all our guys to be polymath. He's a musician. Please support him at Spotify right here. All right, Steph, what do you think? I mean, after looking at all these property prices in Woodlands, the reason why I flash out Woodlands is because Daniel and Stephens, they are North people, right? So they love the North. Okay. What do you think about the pricing?
Actually, I've been having conversations with my friends about this because recently, one of them is trying to get a BTO in Woodlands also.
Right.
And then another one just got one at MacPherson.
Right.
Which is the one near us now. Yeah. Prices now, I don't know, it just feels very expensive. Feels like I don't know, like we've been talking about it. Then we're like as much as you want to afford it, like there's a lot of saving up to do lah. Which I think a lot of people might not think of, or like when they decide to like BTO or get a house, then they'll start to scratch their heads.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know, man. It feels like it's inching up on us.
Yes.
Right. How about Gwen? Oh, Gwen, share with us. You just got a BTO. Congratulations! Yay! Okay. Share with us. What do you think about the BTO prices?
It's honestly a bit crazy. Like, just for a very tiny 89 square meters house, I have to pay about 670 plus.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it because your BTO is in a...
Yeah, it's a central location.
It's quite a central
location. Is yours PLH?
Yes.
Of course, because yours is PLH. Congratulations on getting PLH. Okay, right. Okay, yeah. What do you think also? I mean, like, in terms of the PLH pricing?
I think it's a good measure, though, to help to, like, limit people who just want to buy BTOs to transact higher. I don't think there's anything wrong for property investment, but I think we still have to spread the demographics a bit,
right,
and help the rest that are still trying to cope with the inflation also. Yeah.
Great. Do you like your PLH location?
Yes.
Alright, congrats. Yay. Okay. Okay. So if we were to look at this, Yuron, what do you think? Oh, Grace. Okay, I want to come to Grace. What do you think about this statement? Like, do you think that it will? I mean, what is gonna happen in terms of the HDB pricing moving forward in the next maybe 6 to 12 months, do you think it will plateau with this trend starting already?
Okay, to be honest, I think that the new cooling measures that have been introduced are pretty effective. The most, I would say, powerful one in terms of shaping the HDB market, I would still say, is the one announced on 29 September. The one where, you know, there's a 15-month wait out for private property owners. I think that will be, that is kind of
the biggest
one. Yes, the biggest impact, because private property owners, they are the ones who have the largest kind of cash outlay, right? So looking to downgrade, they'll be able to pay off their HDB properties in full, and then the COV component is not an issue for them as well. Yeah, but I would say that, you know, even observing day to day on the market, the COV part is still a very big part that buyers are considering, right? Because COV, you cannot pay with the grants, you know, it's not counted under your...
How much is the average COV now?
Average COV. So like today, I just got the valuation preview report for one of the units I'm selling. We're asking 580 and the valuation came out at 475. So that is like more than 100,000, right? So then it begs the question whether we should relook at our listing price, or, you know, is it because the listing is so unique, right? And it is that, like, because it has like more than 100,000 worth of renovations. I think you have to consider each home on its own, but one thing I wanted to caution also when we were discussing just now about HDB prices are that the headlines will always be the most impactful, you know, the biggest transactions, the million-dollar transactions. But there are many, many day-to-day transactions that are still very within reach for many people. Yeah. Right. So back to your question, asking whether we are seeing a plateau, I think prices will still continue to rise, but maybe not as... a high of a rate as it was due to unique circumstances during the COVID pandemic.
Right. Thanks. Okay, meantime, I want to pose this question to Yurong and Beatrice about this latest indicator that there might be more rate hikes again. Let's bring in the Nuggets also. All right. Give a round of applause to Nuggets. It's not sponsored by anyone. It's sponsored by PLB.
Actually, at the meantime, right, yes, maybe I can just share that, like, I think we don't need to be too concerned about cash over valuation. Of course, latest statistics is only one out of four transactions actually has a COV component.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, only one out of four transactions have a COV component.
Right. So, it has already stabilized.
Yes, stabilized for quite some time already. So, I think just a general tip to the audience is don't let your perspective be swayed too much by headlines, because the news is supposed to make you... have an emotional roller coaster.
Right.
And
a type of flat also, right? Certain types of flats are more...
Definitely, more prone, right?
To COV than others.
Usually, I would say that, like, older flats, they are slightly more prone to COV because maybe the valuation is slightly more conservative. Like, for newer BTO flats, they're just MOP. As long as the price that is transacted at, I would say that, like, you know, like, it's close to the recent transaction, it is unlikely you will have COV. With regards to just now, you know, like, we talked to our producers asking whether they find that pricing a bit too expensive. I think over the last 11 years, I have never heard of somebody telling me that property prices is cheap. And my conclusion is very simple, because it will always feel cheap when we look back. Just like when I first started in real estate 10 years ago, right? I always hear people say, how I wish my parents would have gotten this type of property, and then now we what already? It's the same situation every time, because at that point of time, your parents will find that property is very expensive.
Yeah.
Right? It only looks cheap because now time has passed and prices is at the kind of levels.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, and of course, I think we talk a lot in our Nuggets on the Go series. And of course, just want to reference a little bit, if this is your first time joining us. Basically, what we always discuss about in our Nuggets on the Go series are a few key things. Because this series is based on a lot more economic fundamentals, as well as global forces that are shaping monetary supply. And for this round, this sharp rise was due to a huge increase in the M2 money supply. So, of course, there's M1, M2, and M3, but M2, this round, basically, there's a huge insertion of money supply into the market because of the pandemic. And US right now, in terms of Federal Reserve, and when we talk about this in detail about, I think in these two episodes, part one and part two, we talk about the property market crash or shift, prediction 2023, and as well as previous episodes on this particular topic. So the main thing is that because of our current monetary system, when central banks increase the liquidity to save certain banks or certain companies from collapsing, they buy back bonds. And of course, with that, they have to insert liquidity into the market. That expands the entire monetary system. That flows to all parts of the world. And if you look at, just need to go to trading economics, and you should be able to figure out a couple of charts right here. Because, for example, you can search on money supply, Singapore, M2. And then it will then bring you to a couple of charts right here. You will be able to see that even in our own chart, just have a look at this rise from 2020 to 2022. Why is the reason that this rose? And then you look at this M2, US. Have a look at this part as well. You'll be able to understand the correlation, because US is, of course, the dominant currency in the entire world. It's considered a global currency at this point in time. So we take a lot of influence from what is happening in the market, which is why everybody keeps talking about what's happening in Fed and what's happening to the interest rates. Why are interest rates so high? And we need to talk about this, right? So last year, rates increased by 7 rounds. This year, 2 rounds already. And a lot of people are talking about the Fed tapering the rates, but it seems that on the March 7th, basically the latest round of meeting, Jerome Powell basically is indicating that he might open the door to higher and possible faster rate hikes, because he wants to use interest rates to tame inflation. Of course, that's a general message. If you look at CNBC, you look at a lot of news articles from US part, you'll be able to keep yourself updated on this portion. And our mortgage interest rates are closely tied to Fed. And that is the reason why our interest rates rose from 1.2% averagely to 4.2% last year. This year, it tapered off a little bit. Okay. But last week, I was just discussing with some bankers. Singapore's government is really smart. Because have a look at the latest. We need to look at this. SORA in Singapore. So there's a shift, right? That's I think there's a reason why our government has decided, MAS decided that we are switching from SORA and SIBOR, from SOR and SIBOR to SORA. And the cutoff date. When is the cutoff date? Let's have a look.
30th June 2023.
Have a look at this. SOR will discontinue after 30th June 2023. SOR and SIBOR will be replaced by SORA. Of course, this is from moneysense.gov.sg, the government website. And why is it that our MAS wants everything to be converted to SORA? What do you think that happens?
Okay, so SORA actually means Singapore Overnight Rate Average in the context of real estate here in Singapore. So what happens is actually when we convert, I think the short summary is when we convert from SIBOR all the way to SORA, basically right. Singapore government, or I would say MAS, generally has more control over regarding the interest rate.
Yeah.
Of lending between local banks.
Yes.
So it has less influence from like the US fluctuation, which is what SIBOR was based upon previously. Right. And this allows us to actually sort of have some form of protection to not be 100% affected by the Fed, which is US central bank's rate increase.
Right, right. And this is a fantastic forecast, because this discontinuation basically, it's in line with a shift worldwide. In terms of the influence from, like example, the US market. So I think, like example, SORA, you look at the rates right now, SORA is like 3.88% if you take a mortgage rate. I mean, it's sort of like taper off a little bit from 4.2%. Of course, if Fed were to increase the rates drastically over the course of 2023, definitely I think our mortgage rate will also rise, right? But I think the discontinuation is a great forecast forward. That by this year, June. Is it this year?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Then I think our rates will be more stable. Okay, something about the rates in terms of mortgage rates in US and Singapore is very different. US, they actually have this, I think it's a very fantastic package. They have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage package. And that, I think that's fantastic because this, I mean, imagine you were to get a rate at a very low interest rate over the course of 30 years. It allows you to predict your rates over a long longevity. And I think that's fantastic. But of course, Singapore doesn't have this. I mean, the longest that we have is like how many years? 5 years, right? Which brings us to one of the questions which is related to this. So there was this question, which I think is a good question, but of course, I think a lot of things for us to unpack, basically about this part here. Okay, from Mr. Andrew. Hi, Mr. Lim. Understand you are an agent, and is your interest to create FOMO so that buyers can pull trigger? You give scenarios of Fed cutting, but you haven't given scenarios where Fed keeps rate higher for longer. Also, Fed cut means they are trying to save the economy from recession. Usually, that means we are in fear and in the bad state. If you want more business sellers that price low in the event, over the next 5 years, it can happen. It has happened before in 2013, 2018. Okay, thanks for this question. So, firstly, of course, for every of our episodes, including our webinars, if you have attended our webinars, we state at the very upfront that all our webinars are crafted in a sense of an unbiased approach, in the sense that there are no product placements in the webinars, that webinars are not crafted to pitch a particular project, because we do not want to craft our webinars in the sense that after you attended a 1.5 hour webinars, then you realize that it's actually crafted with the content intent to lead to a new launch sale, for example. So for PRB, our webinars is very clear cut. If we have any collaboration with developers, we will also aim to come from an analysis angle, but we'll state it upfront in the title that this is a webinar and we'll be talking about this particular project. But our webinars, we aim to be unbiased and no product pitching. Secondly, is that all our banter series, there's no particular properties that we're talking about. We're talking basically about what is happening in the macro economy. So I think it's a great question in the sense that this portion right here talks about the fact that in the past, yes, there was a slide in 2013 to 2018, and we need to revisit that. So what was this slide about? And thank you for the question, by the way, because we love to have questions. But I think this is a fantastic slide to just talk about. And this was also mentioned in our previous Nuggets on the Go series on our PRB channel. This dip was real. There was actually a sharper dip during 2008 US subprime, and this is what we call the Lehman Brothers global financial crisis, where Lehman Brothers collapsed and also Fannie Mae collapsed as well. And this sharp rise occurred in US very drastically. In Singapore, this dip was for a period from 2008 October to 2009 April. That was 6 months. And I remember that very clearly. I was in the market. The whole sentiment was like, oh my goodness, my property price is going to crash. During that period of time, there were properties on fire sale. And a lot of people bought properties at a very low price during that season. However, it was very short-lived because people were trying to wait and wait until 2010, that the market just continued to rise up until 2013. And if you notice, this recovery was so strong that our government has to place in close to 9 rounds of cooling measures. And Mr. Andrew is correct in the sense that 2013, there was a drop in the market because 2013, it was called the grandfather of cooling measures. Why was it called the grandfather of cooling measures? It's because TDSR just took everybody by surprise. Highly calibrated MAS regulation that all your commitments in terms of your car loan, student loan, renovation loan, everything will be checked by MAS. Banks, all banks coincide with one database. And that instantaneously shocked the market because everybody's borrowing power just dipped. So there was a drop in pricing. If you look at the volume, it dropped drastically. And of course, that was the introduction of ABSD. Plus, it was accumulation of 9 rounds of cooling measures on this table. Basically, look at this. One round, September 09, after this, actually, after Lehman Brothers, they stopped the interest absorption scheme. Now, last time, when you buy properties, your monthly installment is so low because you don't have to pay principal. You only pay interest. So last time when you buy a property, let's say your monthly installment is supposed to be 4,000, you only pay 1,000. You don't have to pay the principal, and they stop the scheme. 2080, they dropped the LTV to 80%. Last time, before Lehman Brothers, when you buy a property, you only need to pay 10% down payment. So they dropped to 80. And then they dropped further second loan to 70. So last time, when you buy two properties, both properties can get 90% loan and both properties can get 80% loan as of Feb 2010. And then they introduced the seller stamp duty, and then they started introduce ABSD. And this is, of course, the grandfather of the cooling measures, where suddenly this thing came in June 2013. That technically shocked the market. And this gentleman is correct. 2013 to 2018, this was the period. But when we understand macro, we always share with our audience that it helps us to understand micro decisions. Now, it's very different, because the reason is because we have 14 rounds of cooling measures, but our pricing doesn't seem to stop. The reason is because of the fact that we have already gotten used to the cooling measures. Everybody now buys a property, they don't have to pay 25% down payment. Stamp duty, you have to pay 4 to 6%. You have to hold for 3 years seller stamp duty period. You are ready to own the property. So combining all this, of course, I don't want to repeat the whole Nuggets on the Go episode. This basically is the key reason why now our pricing is very different. And thank you for the question. But yes.
Yeah, just to add on, right? Yes. So why 2013 to actually like 2017, right? This dip happens is because of all the cooling measures, specifically total debt servicing ratio. It reduces the volume because now speculators are further eroded from the market. You cannot do guarantor and all your loans are being checked. I cannot go to bank A and then I go to bank B to borrow for another loan. So all the banks start to share information, right? So in summary, a lot of people are not qualified to take property loans after the total debt servicing ratio in June 2013. So of course, volume dropped dramatically.
Yep.
And now you want to know that the pricing has been the pricing because of a certain volume of transactions, right? And when volume is taken up from the market has to actually accept the new price point based on this new dramatically reduced in terms of the volume. And that is why the 2013 to 2017 is at a consolidation phase in terms of the property price index. And I think all these cooling measures, one thing, what it helps in the market is you realize that it is harder for the rich to want to consolidate wealth in the residential sector.
Yes.
Because now, you want to own multiple properties, you pay additional buyer stamp duty, you want to take a secondary third loan, you can't get 90% or 80% anymore. The loans get smaller and smaller for your second or third loan. And this helps to actually keep prices in check. So that's right. Point one. And that's why you can see that if you were to flash our property price index, right, pre-2013, you realize that when there is a global crisis, our property price will fluctuate dramatically according to the global crisis. But post-2013, realize that global crisis has not really impacted, you know, like a drop in terms of prices, because the cooling measures have already ensured that people who buy into these properties either have already high equity because they paid lots of down payment, they pay additional buyer stamp duty, their loan is being qualified, there's a seller stamp duty. And what it takes away is the action of being unable to afford the property. Mass people, a lot of people are unable to afford the property and they have to start selling, and that's where prices will start tumbling. Okay. So of course, I think summary-wise, prices go up? I would say generally longer-term-wise, the property price index will go up. In between, will there be further dips like you see in 2013, 2018? I think that really depends on bigger fundamentals globally. Bigger macro fundamentals that, of course, we are unable to forecast. But I think how we always advocate to our clients is, number one, to make sure that the property decisions that we make are in line with our individual goals. Financially, we do a prudency check to make sure that we can afford. And we do our stress test. And to actually have a good selection of properties. So that, because you are correct, because over the last 3 years when property price index went up by quite a bit,
yes,
I have seen properties that actually stagnate in prices and didn't go up. And I always joke, like, imagine now it's in a high tide and a beach. Everything goes up and then I'm still not afloat. So imagine if, like, the market is not hot, right? What will happen to these kind of properties? Yeah. So you want to know that not all property prices go up, right? And we know that by being able to select the correct property, we are able to position ourselves favorably,
yes. Yes.
From an investment standpoint.
In fact, there's a lot of properties that are still stagnating. Of course, a lot of factors. Do listen to our episode on mood analysis. And just now, Yurong mentioned a very good point in the sense that there are less speculators because these are the total, these are the proportion of properties that are sold on the TOP year. Of course, sold within 3 years. Notice it's generally less than 20%. 8 out of 10 people buy new launches to stay. And I think the sticky effect is getting a little bit definitely very strong in terms of what people are buying the properties for. Now, Grace, what do you think of this? Very interesting news. $100,000 of rental.
A mark.
Yeah. What do you think of this? $100,000. I mean, this basically shocked the market in terms of the rental.
I'm cautious about headlines because only the, you know, the biggest transactions, the most the outliers, right, make the news.
Right.
If you are, you know, just a everyday kind of transaction, you don't make the news. But it definitely reflects the strength of the rental market and how it's having how the rental market is still on an uptrend. Yeah. So I think for many of the it links to a question that we wanted to discuss today as well. I think on whether we should. Oh wait, no, you already discussed it in the previous NLTG. Rent or buy, right? Yeah. So I think it speaks to the rental demand that persists in Singapore.
Right.
It first started with the COVID pandemic. I think many people were looking to move out, and then also the lack of supply in the market.
Right.
Yeah. And then that kind of pushed everyone to rent. And then as people were looking for bigger spaces or they wanted more independence from their family. And till now, I think there's still no slowing down of the rental rates. However, with more supply being introduced, with more units that are going to TOP this year, I think that, you know, the rental rates will eventually taper down. Yeah.
Right. Great.
Yeah, that is my thought.
How about you, Beatrice? Do you think that the rental rates are horrendous now?
Horrendous? What an extreme word.
From a tenant's point of view.
Yeah, I think tenants, I think we're starting to see some resistance from tenants as well. So, I mean, as landlords, you can ask whatever price you feel like you want to command, right? But I think increasingly, tenants are also having a little bit of pushback, I think, to the prices. I think it has gotten to a point where I think with the new supply of units, the new supply of units that are coming in this year, as well as people giving up their rentals to move into, like, you know, the new launches.
Right.
Supply is definitely, it's going to, you know, you're going to have more supply and that's going to ease up a little bit on the rental situation. But looking at this kind of like staggering 100,000 for a, but then again, the mark is like in a class of its own, lah. So yeah. you can't really compare it to a mass market sort of product.
Right.
The mark is beautiful. It's a single floor plate, 6,000 over square feet with its own private pool. This type of property really caters to not your average expat, that's for sure, on a regular expat package.
Right.
This really appeals to foreigners, ultra high net worth people who still want to come, maybe not necessarily buy a property. And they also like this, clearly they don't want to buy, right? They want to rent. Maybe because of the ABSD, or, you know, for them it's just
try it out for a year.
Try it out, yeah. And it's, this is sort of like a trophy sort of property for them.
Yeah. And this is definitely ultra high net worth category. Mm. Right. What do you think, like, on your own personal opinion basis, do you think that 2023 with the current pricing, is it better for a couple to rent for the next 2 years until 2025, or should they buy this year? Like, based on the life stage, maybe we have to give a very specific life stage that this couple probably have sold off their property last year and they still have not found something to their liking and they are maybe a little bit afraid of the interest rates right now. So what is your personal thought in terms of rent versus buy?
I think rent versus buy, that's the perennial question, right? Which you answered in another episode.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very personal or like a case-to-case basis sort of consideration of like your situation. If you look at like rental nowadays, I mean for a three bedder, let's say in like River Valley now, easily, I mean, very conservatively, 8 to 10K.
Yep.
You know, for like a 3-bedroom in River Valley. If, of course, if the option is there for you to find something that you like, you know, and that you can buy, then you wouldn't want to take the rental route, lah.
Right.
Because then you'll be essentially like paying the mortgage for your landlord, right? Mm. But also, I think increasingly we're also seeing buyers a little bit more cautious. Yeah, they want to take their time. They want to monitor, you know, the market, especially with this year, and see how everything plays out
right.
before they make any rash decisions. So you do have that camp of people also who are taking a more cautious approach.
Mm.
Yeah, rather than, you know, bite the bullet now and then immediately, you know, purchase something.
Right.
Yeah.
Great. Awesome.
Okay, so I just wanted to chime in, right? If we were to jump back to the articles, so we kind of sidetrack and talk about the
rent versus buy.
Mass market and the renting and buying, right? But I would say that these kind of outlier transactions, like 100,000 for a monthly rental, will become more and more common, I think. So as we move towards welcoming more high net worth, as Singapore becomes more and more on the global market,
yes.
recognized for, you know, our stability, recognized for political stability and longevity, I think it won't be surprising that we welcome more and more high net worth into the economy. More and more high net worth who are interested in real estate here or who are just here to work, right? I think the 2030 white paper, we've talked about it many times. The market will see more and more foreigners investing, or not investing, more and more foreigners participation in the economy and the workforce. So, I think these kind of these kinds of transactions will, I wouldn't say a dime a dozen, but more and more frequent as we progress.
Right. You'll be very surprised because I'm very into US content podcasts. You'll be very surprised. A lot of people are talking about Singapore. Mm. Yeah, and there was this particular episode, I forgot what particular show podcast was that. There was this particular entrepreneur, business owner that says that he visited Singapore. By the time he reached home, told his wife that they need to buy more properties in the US because like Singapore is just so expensive in comparison to the US market, right? So I think that's very true, Grace, because if you look at this chart, this was the latest one from Straits Times and Bloomberg. I mean, we're not just on this chart. We're on so many different charts that we are the top 10 luxury market, we're frontier cities, and we're safe haven status. We're the financial center of the world, and there's a lot of headlines about Singapore. Yeah, so what opposed to Euro? Mm. Rent or buy?
Quick answer will be buy. Let me break it down in terms of rental versus buying decision. I would say in generally, number one, ironically, when prices go up, correct, and when interest rate go up, right, you will have an increasing amount of a buyer pool that want to time the market because they don't believe that this uptrend can continue, right? And hence, it will be prudent for me to rent first, wait for the prices to come down, and I can enter at a discounted rate. Most of the time, I would say that most people don't end up in a better place. Renting versus buying. Rationale is because of a few things. Number one, if the renter that you pay, you already incur X amount of expenses. And so you need the price to come down by X plus bonus for you to effectively have any form of good savings. For somebody like me who believes in not timing the market, right? I believe that you should be owning and putting your money in good assets instead of timing in and out. So what it means is because nobody will actually know what is the direction of the market in the next 6 months to 1 year, correct? And if I continue to stay in the market, generally wise, if I have the holding power, the people who stay in the market generally outperform in their portfolio compared to people who go in and out. Because most of the time, people are not so good at timing the market, right? So if I know that today I buy in, I might be buying at maybe the current peak. But if, number one, if I know how to use the mode analysis, have a good project selection, actually, I'm choosing a product that has more upside. So what's important is the product that you purchase, right? Whether there is any relative price potential versus the overall price market, again, in terms of advice. And I think the other thing is number one, because we also mentioned all the cooling measures and all that, even when there is any price correction, I think it's not significant enough to go the rental route. And lastly, I would say that definitely there will be a minor group of people who can actually do arbitrage actions and actually do it well. But this is really a die in a dozen, right? You are really good at understanding how to, you know, like analyze the different markets so much, go into different asset classes. Is this a too long time answer?
No. Just amazed that you have this kind of like, in 华文, we call it 成语. Like, okay, continue. Dime in a dozen, okay.
Okay.
A diamond in the rock.
No. What in the haystack?
Needle. Needle in the haystack. Okay. Thank you for praising.
I need to put back the scenario again, because in case our audience lose track of what the scenario was, is that naturally, some families will rent, some people will rent because they don't have the down payment. But we're talking in the context about a couple that have the down payment because they sold their place, their money is out, right. CPF. They have the ability to buy, but just that they're thinking about. Okay, what's the last point?
Yeah. So I use the arbitrage. Okay. So generally, I would say that unless for people who really understands how to arbitrage properly, right? If not, the probability for generally people who try to execute timing the market is usually not so favorable.
And actually, the most important thing that I think that a family should have is that you should not play with your primary residence. That means you should not time the market if it is your primary residence. Because always remember, there's an op cost, there's an opportunity cost. If this is your primary residence, your family depends on it, your kids depends on it, then you cannot time the market in the sense that the longer you time your market, there's a lot of, I mean, we break it down to the tier level, there's also a lot of logistical issues. You cannot renovate your kids, their schooling needs and stuff like that. Of course, if you're saying that you're trying to rent a place for 30 months to get into a school within a kilometer, that's another whole set of preferences. But generally speaking, if it's your primary residence, if it's your first core asset, then you shouldn't time market. You can, of course, have a little bit of timing for the second, third property if you want to. But the first property, I think there's too much opportunity cost for you to time the market.
I think in the context of when you say timing the market for your investment property, right? I think to put it in a bigger context, you're not trying to time whether is it a right timing, but you're trying to wait for the
right product
with the correct attributes that you feel that has upside potential at the correct pricing. So that is what we mean by timing for the investment property.
Yeah.
And also to put another context is actually, when I say don't rent, I think it's okay to rent if you actually own a property and then you go and rent somebody else's houses.
That's called reinvesting. Yeah.
And then you rent out the one that you own. Yeah. But what we don't encourage is basically you rent without owning an asset. So then you are basically, there's no hedge against like the market movement.
Inflation.
Yeah, yeah. You're only basically trying, the only way that this person wins by renting is when the market goes down by an additional bonus percentage point. Any other scenario, it don't make sense. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Awesome. Great. Now, any final thoughts, Beatrice, to share with our audience about today's episode? Go to Grace first. Final thoughts.
Okay. Before the final thoughts, actually, there's one group of people that I was thinking about when we were talking. I think a lot of clients have approached recently.
Right.
Okay, so this is the scenario, okay? And it's not just like a dime a dozen.
We need to have some sound effects. Daniel and Cephas, like
ding 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 down.
All these kind
of. Use Melvin's original voice.
A needle in a haystack.
Okay. Anyway. Okay. So basically, there have been a few groups of clients that have actually approached I think PLB and myself. The situation is that they own a property for their own stay. Okay, with their family. They maybe have children, young family, maybe a few children. They have sold off this property to buy a new launch. And in buying the new launch, they have to rent for 3 years or however many years till the new launch TOPs. And this new launch property that they buy, right, is not something for eventual own stay. They are just buying to ride on that TOP effect. And then when the unit kind of approaches TOP or they have cleared their seller stamp duty, then they will want to let the unit go. and then purchase their next property. So I think how to say it, that there is a lot of advice in the market that new launchers, you know, you will definitely make money, that you should buy into it so cheap, you know, like at the floor PSF, and then it will increase to 300 PSF, and by then, you know, with the money that you make, you can go and buy the next home. That is the advice, right? But when it comes to execution, I hear a lot of anxiety from the sellers who are, you know, now trying to sell off their new launch, right? Because they witness that the market, whatever they want to buy, is moving so much. It's moving up at a really fast rate, right? So as much as their new launch property is moving up, so is this primary residence that they want to buy. And often, this primary residence is also something of a bigger size, which means that it will move up. If the PSF moves up at the same rate, then the bigger unit will move up at a higher quantum, right? And then there's also anxiety about rent, you know, and then the children's school. You know, they will have to time it carefully such that when they buy into the next place, all their children can transit to the next stage of their school, right? Maybe whether they have to change school or something. Yeah, so yeah, what do you guys think about this?
Based on what I've read.
really?
That's a long question, Grace. Yeah. Okay, fantastic track.
It's a case study-based
okay, question. Based on what I've seen over the past 16 years, I think I need to find one time to tabulate all the transactions. Okay, I witnessed, and I think, based on what I see until today, of course I'm still learning, is that the anxiousness is very high when you rent. For especially at a prolonged period of time. Like after 2 years, you thought that you're trying to hunt for a property within 2 years that you want to buy. After 2 years, you still haven't found, you still haven't made a decision. And then the anxiety just increased. And you then resign for 1 year, 3 years already. And then you renew for another 1 or 2 years, 5 years already. And we have done calculations before. If you rent for 5 years, that portion of rental can actually pay for a lot of interest in your mortgage if you were to buy a property. And there's a lot of intangible factors when it comes to ownership, because we are in an environment where our residential real estate market, we have 90% of people that own their properties. Day in, day out, you hear people asking you, have you bought or not? Your friends will be asking you. There's peer pressure. There's like, maybe your kids were like, oh, daddy, you have to move again. Mommy, you have to move again. And then you cannot renovate. You want to build a cabinet, you cannot build. You cannot build carpentry. You have to buy loose furniture. And of course, there's always anxiousness in the pricing. And of course, your landlord can increase the rent after 2 years. I mean, there's always a minor repair clause. You are servicing the aircon once every 3 months, and then you need to pay monthly. You need to pay the minor repair cost that can be $200 per repair, per item. And every time you think about this, it just adds on to anxiety. So, unless you have a high chance of being posted out of the country, but even if you are in that situation and you are a Singaporean or PR, I think you should still own a property in Singapore, because when you are posted out, you can still rent out this property. And of course, our rents are increasing with inflation and stuff like that. So I think anxiousness is very real if there's a prolonged period of renting your primary residence.
Okay, but we should probably caveat that this is if you do have the down payment. Yeah, yeah. So it's not in the situation.
Consistent.
Correct. Because if you are in a position where you are not ready to buy, then it wouldn't make sense to this conversation would not make sense. Yeah, really.
We're talking about the fact that you can buy.
Correct. So there are many people who maybe they stay with their parents, or they move out and they are renting while they save up for their first property. So that's perfectly fine. And that makes complete sense, right? If that is where you are at in your life stage. It's just that if you have the down payment, you are still hunting for what to buy, but you perhaps lack the maybe advice, or maybe you have not seen something that you like, then there might still be that opportunity cost that you will incur.
Fantastic. Wrong.
I think in summary, I think what's important is, for example, this is what Grace mentioned, this is a case study, right? Basically, you are buying to invest and renting to stay so that you can sort of like capitalize on a property that has good potential while you still get to enjoy to stay in the location that you love. Because sometimes the location I love to stay in might not actually have that kind of price potential that I hope it will be. Of course, I mentioned arbitrage comes with more risk. And I think most importantly is, you want to understand what is your family goals and apply the lowest risk strategy. And I think all boils down to working with the right person to actually have the correct property selection. So in summary, in that context, right? Actually, I lost my job.
What's happening?
Yeah, there was another part that I wanted to conclude versus like rent.
Partly is coming back.
The rent to buy lah. Yeah.
All right, great. Thank you for. Okay, I shall take the liberty to conclude today's episode. Thank you for staying tuned with us on this banter episode. It's great having you, and of course, we hope to see you on the next one.
So if you need somebody to go through like how to build your property portfolio plan in a more stable and safe manner, where we take into account different approaches regards to your financial planning, your goals, regards to how to buy the right property to actually fit into your long-term plans, then you can contact us in this form below. And somebody in PLB, our consultant, will reach out to you.
Okay, like, I mean, even if you are not, you know, you don't need any property advice or what, but you want to stay in the loop of property market, of the property market, you can join our webinars. We have 2 webinars a month, and we cover all sorts of topics about the macro market as well as, you know, a deep dive into HDB lenders and even new launches.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can just keep in touch. You don't have to reach out to us, you know, if there's no specific action plan, but you just want to be in the loop of the property market, then stay tuned to our socials where, you know, all our weekly episodes, our weekly MMTG episodes, where we'll be happy to share more with you.
Right. And you can head on to propertyinvest.com/webinars. All right. So we'll see you on our webinars. And thank you for staying tuned with us on this NOTG banter episode. See you on the next one.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, wait.